Something has shifted in the landscape of childhood, and most of us sense it without quite understanding what's changed. Parents who love their children deeply find themselves locked in daily battles over homework, screen time, and basic respect. Teachers watch students tune out their guidance while obsessing over what their friends think. We've blamed technology, permissive parenting, or some mysterious character flaw in modern youth. But the real culprit is far more fundamental. Children are raising each other. For the first time in human history, young people are turning to other young people, not parents, teachers, or caring adults, as their primary source of orientation, values, and identity. This phenomenon, called peer orientation, has quietly eroded the natural attachment bonds that made parenting work for millennia. It's not that we love our children less or know less about parenting techniques. The ground itself has shifted beneath our feet. Think about 12-year-old Jeremy, locked in daily combat with his father over computer time, choosing online chats with friends over homework and family dinners. His parents feel helpless, their guidance bouncing off him like rain off glass. What's happening here isn't a discipline problem or a phase, it's an attachment crisis. Children come into the world with an orienting instinct as powerful as a duckling's imprint. They need someone to follow, someone to show them how the world works. When that someone is a mature, caring adult, development unfolds naturally. But children's attachment systems don't discriminate between adults and peers. They'll orient to whoever is most present, most emotionally available, most compelling. The brain can only follow one compass at a time. When peers become that compass, everything changes. Attachment unfolds through six distinct levels, each revealing why peer relationships consume children yet remain inadequate. First comes proximity seeking, the endless hangouts that feel essential but lack substance. Second is sameness, the drive to look alike, talk alike, dress alike. When 14-year-old Cynthia suddenly adopted her friend's speech patterns and fashion while rejecting her parents' values, she wasn't being difficult. She was maintaining psychological closeness through imitation. Third comes belonging and loyalty, the fierce possessiveness over best friends and secret keeping that excludes adults. Fourth is significance, the desperate need to matter, making peer-oriented children devastatingly vulnerable to rejection. Fifth is emotional intimacy, though peer-oriented kids typically defend against this because peers can't provide the safety true vulnerability requires. Sixth is being known, sharing one's authentic self, a depth peer-oriented children rarely reach despite constant communication. When peers become primary attachments, these mechanisms that should connect children to wise adults instead chain them to other immature beings. Throughout human evolution, culture flowed vertically from generation to generation. Today, culture flows horizontally among agemates, the blind leading the blind. This attachment crisis stems from massive cultural breakdown, not individual parental failure. Economic pressures push both parents into full-time work, placing children in institutional settings where they spend more waking hours with peers than caring adults. Extended families have vanished, eliminating grandparents who once provided unconditional acceptance. Mobility uproots families from communities. The average working parent today has less than half the free time their 1935 counterpart enjoyed. Most devastatingly, we've lost cultural customs that naturally wove children into relationships with caring adults. Traditional societies had built-in mechanisms, multi-generational gatherings, apprenticeships, community rituals that kept children oriented toward maturity. These have been replaced by commercially packaged entertainment broadcast directly to youth, bypassing adults entirely. Consider the village of Rognes in Provence, where children and adults still greet each other, where festivals bring generations together. This isn't conscious parenting philosophy, it's culture doing its job. We've lost that protective fabric, leaving each family to fight peer orientation alone. The ultimate ethic of peer culture is cool, complete emotional detachment projected as eerie invulnerability. When 7-year-old Kirsten transformed from affectionate daughter to defiant child overnight, her parents tried threats, punishments, timeouts, and reward charts. Nothing worked. Here's what they missed. Parenting isn't supposed to require force. Parenting power flows from the child's dependence specifically on us. When children transfer their dependency to peers, parents lose the invisible authority that made parenting manageable. What looks like independence is actually dependence redirected. The peer-oriented child remains just as dependent, but now on other children who lack the maturity, wisdom, or commitment to guide them safely. Peer-oriented parents also face counterwill, the instinctive resistance to being controlled. This force explains why pressure reduces compliance, why homework requests trigger defiance, why reasonable expectations feel intolerable. When children feel connected to us, counterwill softens. Our expectations seem reasonable because they come from someone they trust. But when attachment breaks, every directive feels like coercion. Peer-oriented children define themselves by not letting anyone push us around, especially not parents. When peers replace parents as attachment figures, children lose their natural shield against emotional wounds. Attachment divides the world into those who can hurt you and those who can't. When peers become primary attachments, every careless comment lands with devastating force. The problem? Children interact carelessly by nature, lacking the developmental capacity for empathy that makes relationships safe. Research shows peer rejection as shattering, but the real culprit isn't rejection itself. It's the attachment void that makes children catastrophically vulnerable to it. In peer groups, vulnerability gets attacked by those already emotionally hardened. Tears invite ridicule, fear provokes taunts, tenderness results in teasing. When vulnerability becomes the enemy, children shut down their capacity to feel, sacrificing emotional aliveness to survive peer culture. This explains the epidemic of cool, defensive detachment masquerading as confidence, and rising youth substance abuse. Drugs serve as emotional anesthesia for the unbearably vulnerable and artificial stimulation for the emotionally dead. Some children merely hide vulnerability, but others have genuinely lost access to their feelings, an emotional shutdown resembling trauma victims. Since this book's publication, the digital revolution has turbocharged peer orientation. The typical teen now sends thousands of texts monthly and spends 10 hours daily with technology. Digital devices were designed for information and business, but humans are wired for connection. To reclaim our role, we must actively collect our children, drawing them close through warm engagement, eye contact, smiles, and physical proximity. This ritual should happen multiple times daily, especially after separations. When we greet children with genuine delight, we signal they belong with us, not their peers. Modern life fragments families through schedules, activities, and devices. We must intentionally create connection rituals, family meals without screens, bedtime routines with undivided attention, weekend traditions prioritizing togetherness. These moments are essential for maintaining children's orientation toward us. When peer attachment has taken hold, restoration requires patience. We can't demand attention. We must become more compelling than peers. This means one-on-one time doing activities they enjoy, showing interest in their world without judgment, and being emotionally available when they're ready. As we consistently demonstrate where they're safe harbor, children naturally reorient toward us, not through force, but because attachment seeks the most nurturing relationship available. Natural discipline follows a simple principle: connection before direction. Collect the child emotionally before providing guidance. When problems occur, work the relationship, not the incident. During upsets, children are dysregulated and parents reactive, the worst teaching moment. Stop harmful behavior if necessary, then preserve attachment. When things aren't working, draw out tears of futility rather than lecturing. Life lessons come through adaptation when children realize something won't work and can't be changed. Be both agent of futility, presenting unchangeable reality firmly, and angel of comfort, helping them move from frustration to sadness to acceptance. Solicit good intentions instead of demanding good behavior. Put children's hands on their own steering wheel. Self-control comes from conflicting impulses canceling each other out, not forced restraint. Create rituals that collect children's eyes, smiles, and nods before school, after school, during meals, before bed. Protect digital-free zones, mealtimes, family times, evenings, bedtimes. In a world engineered to separate children from parents, holding on to our kids requires fierce intentionality. When we hold on to them with connection, not control, we give them the one thing that makes everything else possible, a safe base from which to grow.